Hello and welcome once again to Wrestling Memories. I'm Glenn Broggett. Well, I'm here again with another great week of great wrestling talk. And this week, I do not come alone. I have with me sitting in the co-host chair all the way from the great state of Texas, a guy who's probably a lot warmer than where I'm at right now. He's a lover of pro wrestling history. He's delved into the pro wrestling business and promotions and training and the like. He's been a veteran of the Cauliflower Alley Club. It's so nice to have him back, and he says he's ready to get the rust off the chain and get back into doing radio shows involving pro wrestling. A big welcome to Mr. Mike McCurdy. Thank you so much, and how's that Texas weather, my friend?
Right now, the Texas weather is about 40 degrees, so you know, it's still warmer than where you're at, but you know, we're having our little bit of a cold spell here, so...
Okay, so you guys are making it. Did you guys see much in the way of like snow, anything down there yet this winter?
No snow yet. No snow. We got down to about like 12 degrees here last week, but no snow yet.
Well, you know what, Mike? We have a guy who was probably, we talked about before we got on the mic. This guy, I just hail because he made the smartest decision ever to move out of the Midwest in the winters to go out to the West Coast. This man is already smart in my book. But anyway, we're going to talk about his pro wrestling career that spans back, some 30 plus years. We're also going to talk about some of the promotions, some of the people he worked with, including the WWF and Herb Abrams Universal Wrestling Federation. Where he had a big part both on in front of the camera and behind the scenes for a spell. We'll also talk about his life beyond pro wrestling in the world of Hollywood. We're talking not only acting, stunt work, and other things involved in the entertainment industry. And we're definitely not going to overlook another big part of this man's life, some of the charitable endeavors that he has been a part of. It is such a welcome to have a real smart former Midwesterner with us today. Mr. You can call them Dr. Feelgood. You could call them Mr. Outrageous, or you could also call him Mr. Al Burke. Al Burke, welcome to Wrestling Memories, my friend. Hey, how's the weather treating you?
The weather is treating me awesome. It's a little cool here, too, but much warmer than there. It's a beautiful sunny day in California, and I've got no complaints. And yes, thank you guys for having me on board this morning.
Yeah, it's really nice to track you down. I have been watching, I watch a lot of YouTube, and I came across some stuff with the Universal Wrestling Federation and some of the stuff. It included your work as well on an event that I still, for the life of me, scratch my head how it was pulled off, considering the location and part of the country. And before we go into some of your pro wrestling story and beyond, I want to talk about the time during your time with the Universal Wrestling Federation and just how the heck Herb Abrams and company, you guys, ended up booking a show at one of the more conservative places in the country, the North Dakota State Fair in 1993. Now, Herb Abrams was a little bit rock and roll compared to North Dakota and the State Fair, but you were a part of this show here. I just want to know about this because this has my curiosity and has for quite some time, and was one of the reasons, aside from your other work, that I wanted to get in touch with you.
Yeah, North Dakota, I mean, go figure, especially for Herb Abrams. And at the time, he was working out of Beverly Hills and Malibu. And yeah, it just didn't seem like a match, but I know when he talked to me about it and he asked me, you know, what I thought, I'm like, you know, it was old school, going back to the state fairs, working the armories, you know, that's what we did way back in the day. Actually, they were doing it way before I got in, obviously, but it was, you know, it was that good old feeling. And we went for it and went out there and, yeah, did some TV. It didn't turn out, didn't turn out great. Production wasn't quite up to standard. I know they did finally end up with a DVD of it, but we did have video. And Herb was always a wild ride no matter where we went.
And I want to talk a little bit about it because last week the past 2 weeks here on the program, I was able to track down Steve Ray and the Wild Thing, and was talking about his life and some of his work he did with the UWF. And he was also on that event, and it was also on this video that was distributed. It was on YouTube, of course. So YouTube has many wrestling item and artifact. But he was one of the guys that was a central part of that show up at the All Seasons Arena in Minot. There's even footage of him at the fair on the back. Must have been like a four-wheeler or some sort of all-terrain vehicle promoting the event. And also on one of those gyroscope things that were spinning around. And he was just hamming it up. I mean, it was just such an interesting, surreal experience just watching from that tape of you guys coming up into the North Dakota State Fair.
Yeah, Stevie was a character. We traveled a bit together. Yeah, didn't do a whole lot, but yeah, he was up there. Just everywhere we go, we seem to have fun, and that was another place. And yeah, who would have thought in the middle of, yucca nowhere? The people are always nice up there. I mean, that part's always cool. But, yeah, it's not your Hollywood glitz and glamour, New York City or even Vegas. It's nothing close. But, yeah, we had some fun. And most of it I can't tell you about.
Well, see, that's the teaser right there. And, there was a great lineup. I mean, there were some guys out there. You had the Killer Bees. You had Bob Orton on the card. The Warlord was on there. And you had John Tolos doing the color commentary. So Herba didn't, find some stiffs. I mean, this was a show packed with some guys that had some identifiable names and a little bit of star power attached to it.
Herb always did that well. I mean, The man had many flaws, obviously, but when he put together a show, he really tried to do it right. And yeah, he brought in, like John Tolos, that was the first I met him. Then moving out here to California, I was able to see him, a few times before he got sick. And, but the people he brought in, some of them, big names, legends. That really made it cool, and especially back then. I mean, I was, I think I was probably only in the business maybe, 8 years at the time, something like that. So, it was a big deal to me, working with all these, huge names and, guys like, Warlord, Terry Sapinski. Oh, my God, what a monster of a man, and what a gentle giant. I mean, great guy, another Minnesota boy.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And then you had Jimmy Brunzel, who was up there with Brian Blair with the Bees.
Right. Yeah, no, and I've known, I've known the Bees. I've worked with them. We go way back. I mean, I actually filled in, me and one of my partners, as the Nasty Boys, because they had double booked themselves, and we worked out in Key West, Florida. And that started a whole love romance with me in Key West, which I, to this day, still just, I can't wait to get back there every time. But, yeah, we travel around, we have fun, and, we meet people, and, I'm happy like B. Brian Blair. I mean, I see Brunzy every once in a while, but B. Brian, I see him every year. We talk once in a while on the phone extra. Great guys. Just awesome guys. I love them.
Yeah, and then with Brian involved with the CAC as well. And kind of that's what the note where I bring in Michael McCurdy into the conversation. Mike has been to plenty of past Cauliflower Alley events. And Mike, I want to have you talk a little bit about, ask some questions and talk a little bit about the Cauliflower Alley.
I've actually been with Cauliflower Alley since 2006. I've missed two reunions since then. I've actually had a chance to connect with Al a few times at the reunions. We've had a chance to sit down and talk. And I don't know if he actually remembers me or knows exactly who I am, but at one time at an indie show, he referred to me as a fat logger. So, I had to remind him of that story.
And I still will.
I think he remembers me now, Glenn.
I think so. I think that just rang the old bell, if you know what I mean.
I've always been fortunate. I get to pick on people and make fun of them. And, that was part of Mr. Outrageous being a character. And, you were a prime target there, my brother.
Yeah, the story behind that, though, Glenn, there was an indie show he did in 1993 in Eureka, California, where I moved from. It was my hometown. And it was for a group called Bay Area Wrestling. You remember them, Al?
Woody Farmer. I miss Woody even today. I mean, I love that guy.
But the main event of that show, it was supposed to be Shane Cody, Woody Farmer's son. And he was taking on Johnny Starr, who was the champion. And Shane Cody couldn't wrestle because of an injury. He had a bad leg. So Mr. Outrageous filled this spot. But, of course, Shane Cody was still out at ringside with his on his crutches and all that. I was sitting front row and Shane and I got into it going back and forth. And Outrageous comes out and he's, what's going on out here? And Cody tells me, oh, this tough guy here thinks he can take me on. And Al looked right at me and said, oh, kick your ass, you fat logger. And because Eureka High School, those are the loggers, and that's where the show was. So that was the incident of being called a fat logger, because I was I was a threat to Shane Cody. So,
well, maybe in your mind you were.
Oh, no, I was no threat to Shane Cody. I've known Shane for years, and I'm still not a threat to that man.
I miss that territory. That was a lot of fun.
Mike, any other memories come to mind of some of the times that you were able to encounter Al as well? Do you remember this morning?
This pertains to his acting career, not in ring. But
sure.
I met him a few years ago at CAC. You know, I told him the story of the logger and got a picture taken with him. I go home that year from Cauliflower Alley Club, and my wife's looking at the pictures I took, and she's like, "Oh, you didn't tell me you met him." I'm looking at her, and, well, how do you know who Mr. Outrageous is? I didn't know much about his acting career. She goes, "You don't recognize him?" I said, "Well, yeah, it's Mr. Outrageous, Al Burke. I know who he is." She's like, "No, honey." She goes, "Your favorite movie, The Wedding Singer. You know, The Wedding Singer. What's your favorite scene in that movie?" "The scene on the airplane." She goes, "Do you remember the biker in the movie?" "Yeah." "Oh." Did not realize until that moment that was Al Burke that played the biker in The Wedding Singer.
Yep, the large Billy Idol fan.
Yep. You don't talk to Billy Idol that way. Yep. You got,
yep.
We'll get into that part of your career here, but I want to go back, you know, because I talked about North Dakota. I want to take a little further back in time, because you talked about the Midwest earlier. I want to get into a little bit more of the background information for the listeners today about Al Burke, and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved too into the pro wrestling business. So give a little bit of a bio information here on Mr. Outrageous before the outrageousness set in.
Okay, yeah, I was born and raised in Minneapolis. I mean, part of the time, because my dad raced for Harley-Davidson, you know, I spent a lot of time down in southern Georgia. But, you know, Minnesota was, you know, pretty much my home base, and went to high school and all that, and just south of Robbinsdale, where a lot of the big boys went. But, yeah, just, you know, your typical high school jock. I did not like wrestling then. I wasn't into, you know, rolling around with, you know, sweaty guys is what I told the wrestling coach. But yeah, the football, the hockey, all that kind of stuff. And I'd come out of boxing. I had done karate, and a couple of friends of mine, you know, the Terminators, you know.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Took me over.
Such fixtures of the Eddie Sharkey Pro Wrestling America days. Oh boy, yeah, Riggs and Crow, and oh yeah, Terminators, yeah. Then.
Riggs, who, you know, him and I went back much farther. You know, we were, you know, bikers back in the day and traveled the country on our Harleys, that kind of stuff. But he took me over to Hulk Hogan's apartment. Okay. Back when Hulk was working, you know, his angle with Nick Bockwinkel. And Hulk told us how to get into the business, where to go to school, you know, how to train, all that kind of stuff. And it was funny because I walked away from that meeting going, no, that's really stupid. I can't be a pro wrestler. And, you know, Riggs went off, John Voight went off, you know, Doug Fisher, you know, the three Terminators went off and just started traveling all over. And they come back and, oh, my God, we went here. We're going there. We're having a good time. We hardly even work, you know. We show up, we put in a half hour, we go party all night. So I listened to these stories for 2 years. And finally I'm like, okay, fine. So I went ahead, and Riggs actually trained me. He was the trainer for Eddie Sharkey.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The problem at the time is Eddie did not have a ring that he was training anybody in. He was training on mats on the floor. But, you know, that's also not the right way to learn when you have to work in a ring. So I appreciated Dan for that. He found a ring, and it was, you know, the old Iron Duke, Jim Mitchell.
Oh,
do you remember, you know,
that rings a bell? Yeah. Yeah. And he did some work for Vern. He also did some referee stuff aside from the in-ring wrestling.
Exactly. So he had a ring set up. So we would go there. And so Dan trained me, and, you know, it was awesome. I got into it, and, you know, I've joked with Dan. I still talk to Dan, you know, quite a bit. And I told him, all three of your careers combined, I probably double that. You know, which I'm happy for somebody that didn't want to get into that business. You know, I'm happy for the opportunities I had. I was able to travel the world, do a lot of cool things just because, you know, I became Mr. Outrageous or Dr. Feelgood. And yeah, it was a good run. But yeah, Minnesota, that started it all. And of course, you know, kind of the wrestling capital of the world for many years and many people. It was good memories.
Well, yeah, and you talked about you trained with one of the Terminators. What were some of those early matches like getting in there after you've kind of received the education and then getting in and actually working a crowd? And who are some of those guys that you did actually have the chance to work with in those early outings? And what can you remember of that being, like, how you felt getting into the ring, dealing with, you know, not only in ring, but also with the crowds and actually in the moment instead of being in that training or watching it from afar?
Well, I mean, my very first match, I think it was New Ulm, Minnesota, from what I remember, because we knew people down there. And actually, Riggs ended up putting on a jobber outfit to talk me through my first match. Well, one of the coolest parts for me is my good friend Sherry Martel was sitting in the crowd watching me on my opening match.
Wow.
You know, that I felt was, you know, true inspiration, because I love Sherry, miss her, you know, all that. But, you know, to have her sitting there on my debut match, and of course, you know, I didn't have enough training at the time. I'd come out of, like I said, I did boxing, Golden Gloves. I was 2-time Minneapolis champion. I did karate then. And so, you know, I had a lot of ring presence, but I didn't understand how to work. And I know one time I plastered, you know, because I was one of the ninjas back then. As you know, God, who wasn't a ninja back in the AWA days?
Yeah, throw the outfit on. Get out there.
Yeah, and I ended up plastering, you know, Dan Riggs with a side kick to the chest. And I remember him laughing, you know, because, you know, thank God he's, you know, you know, all muscled up, and, you know, he's a strong man, and, you know, I think he kind of expected it, and I hit him, he goes, Jesus Christ, ref, this guy's a crowbar. Later I had to ask, you know, what's a crowbar? Well, yeah, I was a crowbar. But it was funny, about, no, maybe 8-10 years after that match, I ended up talking to Dan. I go, I just wanted to let you know, I've never forgotten that night, and I'm also now known as one of the softest guys in the ring.
So that was just part of the ongoing education of, learning how to work in full, get past having your trainer come in and walk you through. You were getting in there and you were finding ways to not hurt your opponent and not get yourself involved in a potato fest.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I tell people, because when they ask us, are you all friends? I go, no, you know, there's egos, there's money, there's a lot of things involved, but my best night of work is when I'm working with a good friend, because there's no ego, there's no attitude. We just go out and put on a hell of a good show. If it's somebody we don't like or they don't like us, that's going to be a tough night, and you're probably going to draw blood, you're going to get injured, they're going to get injured, and it's a back and forth. It's not a pretty sight. And you know, later in my career, I always tried to avoid matches like that, because, you know, I was there to entertain, and Mr. Outrageous, like you talk, working with the crowd, I felt a real specialist on that. I could be in the middle of a match, but I'd be so relaxed and hearing everything that was going on, I'd hear somebody say something negative about me. I'd tell the ref, stop! I'd jump out of the ring, walk right over to him face to face, sometimes make him stand up and go, you talking about me, boy? But, you know, I would start that interaction with the fans, and, you know, I ended up doing it before the match, after the match, and, you know, it's something that they didn't get, especially WWF, now WWE, you don't get that.
No, it's
so,
just...
you know, I felt that was an important part to my character, but also the business, you know, get the fans involved, let them have some fun, and, you know, some of the times didn't turn out so well, because, you know, the fans, sometimes they're pretty hateful, and, you know, yeah, I had a few problems there, but, you know, luckily, you know, nothing serious.
I want to fast forward into some of the work, and you ended up getting on some WWF TVs and starting in 1988. I want to get into fast forwarding from the point of you starting your career up to this 1988. And how did you find yourself involved with, ended up getting in on these tapings with the WWF, first of all, and who kind of connected you in to, you know, getting your spot on these TVs, working a wide array of stars at that time?
Yeah, somehow, I mean, I guess I had proven myself enough to the wrestling world where, you know, I had a little bit of respect. Not that I, you know, as a worker, but more as just, I guess, a person, you know, being dependable, that kind of thing. And Tom Stone, you know, Tom Rocky Stone ended up getting a hold of me and saying, you know, I need a booker in Minneapolis area, book out through all of Minnesota. And so it was really, you know, Tom that brought me in, and we started booking. I remember one time, I think I had like 25 guys I had to bring to a taping. I think we rented 4 or 5 vans. But yeah, those are, you know, the good old memories. I mean, I remember I always tried to include Todd Becker, Todd and I. Todd was just a sure. guest on yours a few weeks back. And, you know, Todd and I still talk, you know, maybe once a week, you know, twice a month, whatever. You know, I keep track of his kids. He keeps track of mine, you know. We follow each other's family. Todd and I mean, we were in North Dakota together. We actually roomed on that tour.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Todd definitely has some good memories of that one as well, and working and hanging out with you, too.
Yeah, no, and, you know, it's, you know, it becomes a family for the most part, you know, and stuff like that, people like that, you know, just make the whole memory of my wrestling, you know, history, if you want to call it that. Just really nice.
Yeah, you mentioned Tom Rocky Stone, and also I was just looking at some of the guys that you did work the TVs with, you know, in tags. I mean, you talk about Tom Stone, and also amongst that group, there was guys like you mentioned Todd Becker. Another guy who I've had on twice on the program was Chris Curtis, and I see that you worked a match with, well, they were the Bushwhackers then. They were formerly the Sheepherders. You worked some tags, one of them with Chris Curtis. So I want to talk about working with Chris and also the Bushwhackers. I mean, those were guys. Around the time that they got their promotion, they went from bloodthirsty, barbed wire, cut up New Zealanders to fun-loving Kiwis. I mean, that had to have been a trip working in the ring with Luke and Butch.
Well, it was so funny because I'll go with the Bushwhackers first. They're sitting talking to you through the whole match. And it's not the guy that you're in the ring with. It's the other guy outside the ring. And they're making jokes. And I was trying to keep from laughing. It was so hysterical and so much fun. And I wish I would have got to work with them more because, it was really a fun night. All these guys, you know, Curtis included, I mean, fun times, traveling all over. Just, you know, these road trips. I mean, Todd and I and many of my other friends still talk about the road trips we had. And how much fun we had. And, you know, it was not like we got in trouble, which we did a few times. But,
well, it's only natural, right?
But it was just fun hanging out together and traveling. And we'd be on, you know, a 2 or 3 day tour, which wasn't much back then. But, you know, the cool part was it wasn't like the old 5-0 go slow. Our expenses were covered, our vehicles, our hotels. You know, we got fed, you know, the day of tapings, you know, a nice buffet. And, you know, it was just one of those things. It was really good times.
Mm-hmm. And you work. I want to talk with some of the stars you did get a chance to work with too, aside from the Bushwhackers. While we're talking a little bit about your work off and on with the WWF, a recent shot that you shared on your page online on Facebook was you caught in the grip of one Big John Studd. Now I know the match wasn't a Broadway, but what was it like working with John Minton? I mean, this was one of those big, larger than life characters that was part of that early rock and wrestling thing of the mid '80s. And then ended up returning back to the Federation around 1989.
Yeah, John, I mean, a true monster of a man. Oh, my God, was he big. I did not realize how strong he was. I started off the match. I mean, I thought, you know, he's big. I'm going to get in a couple licks quick. And so, you know, I hit him twice, jumped up on the rope, got to the second, turned around, and he was right there, grabbed me by the throat. He took me off the ropes with one arm and held me. I'm like 240 at the time. he slowly started losing me because of my weight, put his other hand under my ass and just threw me into the turnbuckle. I mean, I took a short rib there, I took a little bit of air, and I'm like, holy crap, is this man strong? I had no idea. Great guy. Another sad death in our, our long, long list of, dearly departed. But no, I was very honored to work with guys like that, the Ultimate Warrior, stiff as that SOB was. but like Andre, I stepped in the ring twice with Andre, and both times Colossal Connection. First time they weren't tag team champions in the WWF, the next time they were. So, what an honor. I mean, I laugh at the kids nowadays. It's like, you don't understand what we got to go through back then. We got to work with the biggest legends in the whole world. And, for that, I'm eternally grateful.
I got to ask you, too. I mean, not only Andre, and this man may not have been big as far as like in height stature, but the other half of the Colossal Connection was just as big and badass in his own right. Haku.
Yeah, I never got to personally work against Haku other than in the tag match. Yeah, he was one of those that the word was out. If anybody's legitimately badass, he is one of them. Don't ever screw with that man. stories like that always stuck with me. I mean, I'm very good friends with, like, Paul Orndorff, and it turns out, Paul, same thing, not a big man, but, some of his stories, and Paul and I have got to hang out many times. We did many tours together, but you find out these stories when, like Paul takes on, Tony Atlas, and, makes Tony submit. that's some badass boys out there. And no, you always learn, never underestimate anybody, and basically know your place. Don't try to climb the ladder because you got big cojones, because most of the time you're going to get hurt.
But it was such a great education you got too. I mean, to be able to not only get the TV coverage, but you were working through those years off and on from 88 to 93, these WWE shows or WWF shows at the time, with just such a who's who. I mean, we talked about some of the big heavyweights, but you also got to work with bona fide in-ring legends like, Dusty Rhodes. We're talking about the Kerry Von Erich, the Texas Tornado, some guys, that aren't with us anymore, and Hercules Hernandez and... Yeah. These guys, you even got to work, you took a Superfly Splash, you took a DDT from Jake. I mean, how many other people nowadays, again, these kids could probably sit under your learning tree and just talk about these tapings and how you were just in such a good position to work with these guys and make them shine.
Yeah. A quick story about Superfly. I got to work with him twice, WWF tapings. The first time I got the Superfly at the end, I saw stars, I saw bubbles, I saw little birdies flying around. I swore he landed on my head. I mean, I thought I'd been damn near knocked out. And I'm out there trying to clear my head outside, and the guys in the TV van are laughing at me because they can see me, and they go, "What's wrong?" And I go, "God damn, he had to hit me in the head." And they go, "No, he didn't." They brought me in the van, replayed it, and showed me it was strictly chest to chest. That's the type of collision, which most people don't realize. And then a couple months later, I got my chance to work with, Jimmy again. And I had, hit the gym even harder and worked. And when he hit me, no stars, no bubbles. I'm like, yeah. But then I remember during the match, all of a sudden I saw his face turn. I'm like, oh, crap. I pissed him off. He's going to kill me. He wound up to hit me, and he was as light as a feather. It was all show. And I'm like, damn, you are good. But yeah, guys like that, Dusty, I loved working with Dusty. Unfortunately, another one that's passed, but what a legend. Yeah, so I'm very fortunate. I think I had like 30 TV matches with WWF, and I'm just, I'm thrilled to death even today that I had that opportunity to work with, like you said, these legends. It's awesome.
Yeah, and not only the singles, but the tag teams. I'm looking at you when I was researching for this interview. I mean, you got to work with the Steiners, the Nasty Boys, the Hart Foundation, just to name a couple of these big tag teams. I mean, and you got these guys when they were in their prime tag team years, too. So you got some young and hungry guys. You got these, you know, the Hart Foundation. What a solid team. The Rockers, the High Flyers. And then you got the guys that sometimes the matches look like the opponents were in a car accident, the Steiner Brothers. I mean, good Lord, what a variance of styles you got to work in the ring with.
Very, very fortunate. The Road Warriors, guys like that. You know, I forget who it was. It might have been the Steiners. I was their first match coming to WWF when they moved over. So they, you know, of course, you know, they've got something to prove to the world, you know, that they're worthy to be there. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't a horrible night. It was a snug night, as we call it. when they laid their stuff in, it was solid. But luckily, I was in shape, and you know, I never complain. And but yeah, it was a bit of a brutal night. Not as bad as Warrior. I mean, the funny part is, I faced Big John Studd one night, and the next night I faced Warrior. I was in bed for a week after that. I was so hurt.
Just
you know, but you know, it's what we do. You know, it's a life we live, and people laugh at us that don't understand our business. It's like, why would you do that? I'm like, because we love it.
We're talking with Al Burke, and Al, we're going to move now from the WWF, where you worked some major stars, worked with, to, again, we touched on it very early on in our interview. Here's kind of our opening salvo. We talked about the Universal Wrestling Federation and Herb Abrams and how they booked the big show that you were part of at the North Dakota State Fair in 1993. But I want to talk a little bit more about how you came and crossed paths with Herb Abrams. Again, I just talked with Steve Ray, and he talked about his relationship with Herb and just what a fascinating person. He's not exactly a made for primetime player type of guy. But I mean, through the years, there's been some stuff that's been said about Herb and some things that it may have been stretched or may have been not as stretched as far as it should be. But I want to talk about how you got into the wonderful world of Herb Abrams, a Beverly Hills guy who got into the wrestling business.
Well, you know, once I moved to California here, and actually first step is I had gone to the AWA, and Eric Bischoff was in the office, and Eric and I knew each other from our karate days. And I says, you know, I've got all these years in, I think I'm ready for a push. He goes, sorry, we're closing the doors next month. So I'm like, okay, well, you know, that was, you know, that little thing. And a month later, I got Herb's personal phone number, and I called him up. I says, told him who I was, and he goes, yeah, I heard of you. What do you want? I go, we need to talk. I want to work for you. So we sat down, and one thing I never did is take shit from Herb. And, you know, a couple times I go, you know, don't be a schmuck. And he looked at me and go, no, don't worry. I understand what a schmuck is. And I started talking to him in Yiddish, and I'm not Jewish, but, you know, and he looked at me and he kind of smiled, and I think he liked the fact that, you know, I wasn't going to take crap from him, and I never did. And he hired me, and we did the North Dakota show, and pretty soon we're working on the MGM Grand show, which has, you know, one whole story behind it, which we won't get into now, and I'm surprised they didn't kill Herb, but he ended up, you know, moving me into the office, and I became his confidant. We traveled to Israel together on tour, you know, a lot of fun, you know. Dr. Death Steve Williams and I were invited with Herb to go to Maui. That was about a month before, you know, Herb had his incident in New York where he basically, you know, his heart stopped, and he basically killed himself just out of fear. But, you know, it was a ride that I'll never forget. I'm still mad at Herb because that man, he could do anything he wanted. He could go out and raise $500,000 on a weekend for his next show. I mean, he had the gift of gab. He just knew how to, work people. If he would have just stayed off of drugs, he would be, you know, still, you know, one of the biggest promotions in the world. I mean, it's tough to beat Vince, but he'd be, you know, he'd be an EV, very easy second place to that.
Yeah, and it's just a shame that, again, some of his antics, you know, really kind of overshadow just how an aggressive guy who wanted to get into the wrestling business, who had that passion for business, and just what he really did bring to the table. Because when he opened up those tapings initially and through the run of the UWF, there were a lot of guys that passed through that were, you look at some of the cards and the pay-per-views and TV tapings, there was some big star quality out there. I mean, you had guys, you know, like Terry Gordy, Paul Orndorff was on these events through the years. You had Colonel the Beers. You had Bob Backlund, Mick Foley when he was Cactus Jack, Bam Bam Bigelow. You even had freaking Bruno Sammartino for a spell. So, I mean, this was a guy that wasn't messing around.
But he even had Andre the Giant.
Amazing.
Did you know that?
No, please tell a little story about how he got Andre.
I don't know. I wasn't with him then, but I had seen things that Andre had come in for one of his tapings even. No, you know, Herb pulled out all the stops trying to play the game. And, you know, he did a good job. He just, you know, he had too many demons in his closet. But, no, you're right. He brought in some huge, huge names in our business.
Yeah, and he also, was able to secure, I mean, they were on TV. I mean, the Sports Channel, a USA deal was a big one for a while. And even to the day with UWF, you could see it, 5-10 years ago, even nowadays, on ESPN Classic.
I had lined up a lot of that, personally. Uh-huh. Todd Okerlund, Mean Gene's son, was the distributor of UWF material for me. I haven't talked to Todd in a while. I see Mean Gene, but yeah, I've got to give Todd a call. You know, it was one of those things. Once Herb died, I mean, even my wrestling tights that I had made as Dr. Feelgood, those pretty much went into retirement. I mean, I was very saddened by his death, and a lot of that I just put away. And I've got, I was in charge of all of the footage. I still have all of the footage.
What were the plans? I mean, you talked with Todd Okerlund and stuff. Another guy that I know that's involved in the distribution too was Polish Joe Chupek as well from Minnesota.
Yeah, I never worked with him. I think Todd and him might have worked together. But no, I happened to meet Todd. I had lined up with a guy out here in Santa Monica, and we worked together. And unfortunately, he became a not a trustworthy person. Whole nother story, but I ended up calling Todd personally then and talking to him, explaining who I was, and gave him basically, the letters from Herb that put me in charge of, all West Coast operations for UWF. And, like I said earlier, I mean, I think I'm one of those, trustworthy people. One thing Riggs told me in the very beginning, and to this day, I live by this: your word is worth gold until you break it once, then it's never worth anything again. And so I've always tried to live by that and make sure, what I say is what I do. And then, I've had a few incidences where, like, I've had to go to a promoter and say, hey, I just got booked in Japan, but I know I'm booked for you. What can I do to be released? Not screwing them over, not, just going. And I made sure, stuff like that. So you try to, try to be an honest, trustworthy person, and it'll follow you through your whole career. So Herb wasn't quite that way, though.
I want to talk how you parlayed. You went from pro wrestling, how you got into the world of Hollywood and the world of acting and eventually stunt work. How did that door open up for you and lead to some big roles, including the one that Mike definitely remembers now in the Wedding Singer? But how did that door get opened up for you?
I get a phone call from Carl Lauer. He was the promoter out here on the West Coast for many, many years, and he still is back in the Midwest now where he's moved back. But he calls me up, and I'd done a couple of charities with, like, Professor Tanaka and Budokan and stuff. We went off and, did some things. So Carl was aware of me, and he calls me up and says, I got this movie part I want you to read for. All you have to do is beat up, kidnap, and kill Mexicans in East L.A. I'm like, that's not a problem. Where do I sign up for this? And I ended up going in, and the movie, I was working with the Lucha Libre guy. So we had some great fights. It was awesome. And that was my start. And in fact, a couple of years ago, Carl always gave me crap. He says, I never paid him back for that, getting him giving me my break. Well, I happened to get a one penny residual check. So I had it framed and I presented it to Carl one year at the CAC. I go, don't spend it all in one place and now we're even. What the movie, none of us ever got paid for, even as investors, we lost money, but welcome to Hollywood. But that was my start in Hollywood, working as an actor. And, one of my dreams always was, I wanted to be known as a Hollywood stuntman. And I thought if I could just do one, I'd be happy. Well, I've had dozens and dozens. I do tons of driving. I'm a precision driver along with a stunt driver. The difference being precision, you never touch. Stunts, you kiss, as we call it. You know, you'll kiss the door handle, you'll kiss your bumpers, your fenders. You can roll them over. You break your tires loose. There's your difference. But it was such an intriguing world to me. And so, that's what I did. I went off and got an agent and, started getting work. And just like the wrestling world, you learn how the business works and how you can make it work for you. And I finally did that. Now, every year I've averaged approximately 100 jobs a year, which is, basically two jobs every week, which I can live on. I can have fun with. So that's kind of my goal, and I'm just happy with that and keep moving forward and having fun.
And I want to mention another guy who, from the pro wrestling world and also just one tough son of a gun that crossed paths in your life, Judo Gene LaBelle.
Yes. What a great guy. I told my dad years ago, I go, I think Judo Gene was about, 80-something at the time, low 80s. I told my dad, in my prime, when I was the biggest, baddest, toughest I ever have been, he would have made me cry like a little schoolgirl within seconds. I go, he is that legitimately badass. But same thing, nice guy, no attitude. I can thank God I've never been choked out by him. He's never, he's never gotten aggressive with me. He's a great guy. I mean, I love him. Another great run in Hollywood. I think he's got, like 400 credits in Hollywood. I mean, he's done well. He's done well.
Yeah, yeah. I want to bring Mike back in. Mike, the name Carl Lauer comes up, and I know that gets your antennae up, being a vet of the Cauliflower Alley Club. You want to talk a little bit, because we mentioned a little bit about that wedding singer stuff, too, but I had to mention that the name Carl Lauer back to you, because I know that'll get you going a little bit.
Well, Carl's a great guy. I've, like I said, known him since 2006 and all that, and I was around when Al gave him the check for the penny framed and all that. So I remember all that, but I do want to touch on the fact, we are talking your Hollywood career and the wedding singer, and you heard my story a little bit ago, but that scene, and if anybody who's watched the movie, we all know the scene, it's where, Adam Sandler wins the girl at the end of the film. But your part is, in my opinion, I think a lot of other people, that line and what you do is kind of an iconic part of that scene. How did you get to audition for that and get that part? And did you realize that at that time that was going to be kind of one of those scenes and one of those memories that people are going to take from that movie?
When I first got the audition, I got it through one of my agents at the time, and I went in and read, and I just read with the casting director, and she was saying, go ahead and, encroach my territory, which means I could get in her face because that was the kind of character it was. And we didn't have a card or anything, but I actually had a couple of lines in that. I knock him to the ground, and then I also drag him off to the bathroom, which turned out we couldn't shoot. But anyways, we get to that, and the girl says, that's a great job. I loved it. That's the good news. Bad news, I need to see you back here in 4 hours for the director. Okay, so I did that, and I thought I had a pretty dang good audition, and the director was even, no, get in my face, touch me. And we were really nose to nose, our noses were touching, and I was like, don't you talk to Billy Idol that way. And it was like a month later, I think it was actually 28 days later, I get a call, oh, you booked the job. I'm like, what job? I haven't been out for anything for a while. Oh, the wedding singer. That night, I get special delivered the script. Now, at the time, the part I was reading for was the big fan, but it was David Lee Roth. So I was excited. Love the song. Love the band, all that kind of stuff. And then, I get the script, and it switched to Billy Idol. I'm like, oh, wow. I go, I guess that makes sense. So I was very happy with that. Showed up. Everybody was awesome. One of the coolest nights of my whole life was the wrap party. When we were all done, they threw a party for us. Billy Idol brought his whole band and gave us a private concert for over an hour. Billy let Adam Sandler play lead guitar on everything. I had no idea Adam was that good. So it was, you know, I mean, I was standing, there was nobody in front of me. I could reach out and touch the speakers. That's how close I was to them. What an awesome night. And, you know, I was thinking, oh, my God, I've made it. You know, I'm going to get these every week. Well, that didn't quite happen. In fact, I've never had a party like that since. But, no, one of those cool memories, and I'm very thankful I was given the opportunity to do that. And, yeah, it's kind of become that iconic phrase. You know, it's one of those I've seen a couple of different websites where it's, you know, that's up there with, you know, the best one-liners in history. So I'm kind of proud of that. I mean, you know, it had nothing to do with me other than I delivered the line and I was the character in there. And, but yeah, it's fun. And the cool part is I'm still getting paid money for it.
And the bottom line, that's what we all want is the residual check. But another thing in your acting career, I'll touch on this a little bit. People I'm sure might realize you've done music videos with LMFAO, who a few years back was kind of one of the hot bands at the time. And, you know, their videos are fairly comical and, you know, entertaining and all that. But how did you, was that just another case of just went in for an audition? But what was it like working with on the music videos?
I actually auditioned for Red Foo. I remember I was standing there. They walk us in and there was a line of us. I think there were either four or five of the different characters. You know, you usually never go in with the same character. So I wouldn't go in with another cop. And Red Foo's at the table, and he's, you know, he's got all of our pictures. Not, mine wasn't there yet because I had an audition, but I was standing there waiting. He goes, okay, this is our cop. And he looks up and goes, oh, wait, that's our cop. So, I, you know, I had a good feeling, but you never know in Hollywood. But, yeah, they hired me, and then they wanted my junior partner in the scene. They glued on a mustache that, you know, resembled mine. And I actually dressed him. I brought one of my uniforms, but they're like, no, he's not worthy of having the full uniform like you. He's like the rookie. So we dialed him down, but yeah, it was cool. I worked two nights on that. Like, even like the wrestling, you know, I made a lot of cool friends after that shoot. Very colorful video. In fact, I use it as one of my shots on my Facebook page because it is, you know, cool. And yeah, I come in, I go to arrest Red Foo, and he turns around waiting for me to cuff him, and we sneak into the party. We're there to party.
Going back to the wrestling just for a minute, you mentioned a couple things when you were talking. You said that some of the kids nowadays wouldn't understand, you know, or know anything about the legends you got to work with, and you talked about your training in the ring, and you worked on mats. I work with a training school, and I help to train. And we have the mats, so there are still schools that do the mats. And we try to instill some of the history into our kids and let them know, hey, you know, about these people and kind of lay down some of the groundwork for them so they kind of know where it all came from. But what's your take and your opinion now on the current scene? Because there's wrestling schools. I mean, you can throw, like, a rock, like, 5 feet and hit a wrestling school. And a lot of areas you can find little indie federations everywhere for kids to work. And sometimes, you know, they may not be ready to be in that ring yet because the school may not be as, you know, accredited. When you were training, you know, you actually had to know people and you had to be recommended. It was harder to find a school back then. But what is your take now on just the current training and indie scene?
Yeah, you're very correct. None of us old schoolers are happy with where any of our business has gone. Yeah, wrestling, anybody, you know, anybody can train anybody and now they're officially a pro wrestler. No. It's sad. I mean, I ended up locally here. I heard about a backyard wrestling show and I knew the kid because my daughter went to school with him. So I went to the show. And I talked to him. I'm like, you guys are crazy. And he had done a barbed wire match, and he was sitting there all disappointed. He goes, I thought I would be bloodier. I'm like, that's not the point, dude. He goes, oh, no, I want it to be. I'm like, no, you're missing the point. So I steered him to a wrestling school. He ended up going, but, you know, the young guns of today, he ended up breaking his neck. I mean, he wasn't paralyzed, but he could never work again. I remember talking to him about that. I'm like, how did that work for you? I go, I'm still working. At the time, I had, you know, I was in my, you know, early 20s for years. I'm like, I've been doing this for a long time, and I still get to do it because I'm smart. Yeah, but it was so much fun, and I had to do this move. I go, and that move cost you your whole career. But, you know, the kids nowadays just don't get that. I remember Riggs had told me during my training, he goes, you go to the second rope, you could hurt yourself. You go to the top rope, you could cripple yourself. What do you want to do? And, you know, all these things, you know, I mean, you know, Dan was old school and, you know, old school wrestling, and you learn to chain, you know, you learn to put, you know, holes on. And, yeah, nowadays it's like, how many high spots can I get in? And, you know, okay, now it's your turn to do your 20 high spots. I'll come back with my next 20. And, you know, there's no story. There's no anything. So that part is sad, I think, to most all of us. But, you know, they're not listening to us. They've got their own ideas. And like I said, anybody can open a promotion. You know, anybody can buy a ring now. Yeah, it's our business has changed. You know, many of us veterans, if you want to call us that, you know, old timers, you know, we talk about it from time to time, and, you know, sometimes we'll tell the kids, I'm like, you guys are going about it all wrong. And, you know, me, I mean, I was able to get over 30 years in the ring, actual wrestling. Yeah, I had some injuries and, you know, and stuff like that, but, you know, you have to be smart. It is a work, and we were talking earlier, you know, when you get with somebody you don't like, you know, you may, you know, you try not to permanently hurt somebody, because that's the way they make their living. They pay their bills, they feed their family, whatever. So you don't try to intentionally go out and cripple them. But, you know, putting in a little sting here and there never hurts.
Do you watch any of the current product, either indie or, you know, the national, what's on TV?
None of it. Not 1 minute.
Just something you're not interested in anymore.
As a former worker, no, unfortunately not. I mean, every once in a while, like Sin Bodhi from Freak Show Wrestling will want me to do a special appearance, and mostly I come in and, you know, take a big monster bump off of one of their guys, because I can still do the big monster choke slam and things like that. But no, I realize, you know, I've moved beyond that. It's not for me, but, you know, we're just not happy with what we see happening out there. And yeah, I mean, I've got people that are heading to the big WWE event down in New Orleans, whatever that is. And I was invited. I'm like, hell no, I'm not going to that. I did take my daughter about 10 years ago, because she was a super fan, and I went and watched a Raw and whatever else, you know, TV taping, and I sat there and just like, you know, it just isn't like it used to be. And, you know, that's my problem now, because everybody's moved beyond me, and that's okay. I can live by mine, and I hope they can live by theirs.
I want to, just before we go here, because we got a little bit of time left, timekeeper's looking at me, giving me the eye. I want to talk about some of the non-wrestling, the non-acting. I want to talk about some of the charitable stuff that you've been a part of here in recent years. I want to talk about some of the charities that you were involved with. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I've done many charities. The main one's been Special Olympics. I've traveled all over for them. I've done 4 of their World Games. So, you know, pretty proud of that. Made a lot of friends out of the Special Olympians. And when you realize the Special Olympians are some of pro wrestling's biggest fans, I saw the real attraction there when I first got into the business. So that's been one. I've been called in to do 3 make-a-wishes, and 2 out of the 3 died within days of my visit. That's very tough. I hate to get that call. I mean, I don't even want to answer the phone, but of course I do, because that's the kind of person I am. And I was given the Jason Sanderson Humanitarian Award a few years back here because of all that I'd done. Jason didn't even realize everything, you know, or much of what I'd done, because I don't make it public. I'm, you know, that's not the Mr. Outrageous, let's get in front of the camera press. That's just me and whoever I'm happening to visit. Yeah, you know, I've done burn units, I've done Shriners hospitals. I mean, this stuff it's tough. It tears your heart out. But, you know, and the hardest part, like I said, when I have these kids, you know, dying, that's just not easy. I mean, but, you know, welcome to life is death. And, you know, I've had to adjust to that. But no, I try to do charities. It's my way to pay back. I'm always happy to do that. And I think it's a big part of becoming a whole person, is by, you know, giving to somebody without ever wanting anything in return.
What do you got cooking here in your not-too-distant future? Have you got any work that you've lined up as far as stunt work or acting or videos and the like?
Well, the biggest thing I have right now, I've been working on it for about a year now, is the Machine Gun Preacher 2 movie. Anybody who saw the first one, Gerard Butler played Sam Childers, who is the real Machine Gun Preacher. Well, I'm a personal friend of Sam's, and I have a starring role with Gerard, if we can all get our schedules together, in the second part of that series. I did go to Africa a couple of years ago. I directed a movie over there in Uganda. We just finished it a couple of months back, so now it's ready to get distributed. It'll be shown in theaters over there. So, those are the things. I mean, I'm now putting that out there because I've got to go to film festivals promoting it. I'm also up for a TV series. I should find out the end of this month if we get to shoot the pilot. We've already shot photos. It's kind of a Mad Max type of character. I mean, I have a Mad Max type of bike. My front fender has 4 real saw blades welded to it.
Oh, so cool, man.
They're still kind of sharp. They will take your skin. They will rip your clothes. I mean, they're sharp enough for all that. So it's a pretty radical bike, and I don't ride it a lot. It's more for the movies. But, it's a fun, cool thing that Mr. Outrageous gets to do.
Mm-hmm. And where are you at on social media if people want to, take a glimpse into the life of what Mr. Outrageous is up to?
Mr. Outrageous actually has his own Facebook page. Usually the other, my personal page is more for people that I have worked with. I normally don't take fans on that, but Mr. Outrageous page we can. From there, I leave my pages open to the public. I'm not hiding from anybody, so that they could go to my page. I think I have almost 700 people on my, want to be friends list that are waiting right now. like I said, I don't take fans. I mean, I'm not trying to be difficult or be an ass or be stuck up. It's just, I try to keep that low because these are people that I really know and I have worked with. If they want to go to Mr. Outrageous, Mr. Outrageous still has a MySpace page. I just talked to somebody yesterday about that. MySpace is still alive, but because of the bands, and I've done over 200 music videos. So these bands are all over MySpace because that's still one of their main ways to communicate all over the world. And I've got like 300,000 friends on there. It's not a real active, my Facebook stuff. I don't do anything else. I just don't have the time. I love working and I try not to be stuck at my computer. If you try to talk to me on there, usually I can't because I don't have the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we head out, I want to shift it back over to Mike McCurdy. Mike, you have one more question here before we part ways with our guest today, Mr. Al Burke.
This is a question. I hosted a podcast for about 2.5 years, and this is a question I always like to ask a lot of the veterans, the ones who have been in this for a while, but looking back on your career and looking forward, what is something you would like people to remember you most for as far as your in-ring career?
I guess that I was entertaining. I was playing a bigger-than-life character. Mr. Outrageous could do anything, could wear anything. I mean, that was the whole character I developed with that. But just that I was fun and entertaining. I mean, don't take it too seriously. If I picked on you and if I called you a stinking fat logger, too bad, get over it.
I'm still hurt by that.
No, you're not. Shut up. We'll talk in Vegas. But no, it's all the character. It's not me. I mean, I've heard things that I've apparently said before, that I feel bad about because I didn't mean it the way it was taken. I will tease you like there in front of God and everybody, but it's not really personal. It's part of the show, and I want everybody to know, please believe that, because I really try not to ever be a mean, evil person. So I guess that's the biggest thing.
Well, thank you so much for the conversation on this day, Mr. Al Burke. It was a pleasure, and boy, it just, this hour went so fast. The timekeeper, again, has to tell me I got to follow the rules, but anytime you find yourself available to talk about some of your projects or whatever you're working on, you always have a place here at Wrestling Memories, and I want to thank you, as well as Mike, on behalf of Mike, for stopping by today. It was a real honor.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I enjoyed it. Yeah, time flew by. I mean, yeah, you know, like I said, walking down memory lane is always awesome because they're great memories. And thank you for having me on your show.
You're very, very welcome. For Al Burke and Mike McCurdy, I'm Glenn Broggett. This is Wrestling Memories.